Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. I'm really excited about today, and I'm excited to share with you the interview that I just did with Eben Kirksey. Now, Eben just edited this fabulous book called The Multispecies Salon. This was produced by Duke University Press in 2014, and it's a book that is exciting not just for what it contains, but also for how it models a way of thinking and being part of a scholarly and artistic and thinking and human and cross-human and interspecies collective. So what the book does is it collects essays, recipes, accounts of projects, thoughts in three different parts of the book: Blasted Landscapes, Edible Companions, and Life and Biotechnology. Not only does it, in doing so, really open up for us a window into some really wonderful works, some collaborative works by scholars working together, some work by artists, some work that's grown out of collaborations across the arts and the humanities, but it also models, I think, what can happen when you really enter into a kind of a series of gatherings, a volume, any kind of relationship with other scholars and other thinkers in a spirit of curation, a spirit of care, a spirit of opening, playfulness. And if we do that, and I think if we do more of that, then the kind of scholarly interactions that many of us probably are used to having at, you know, big conferences and the like, sitting at our computers, authoring single authored works, this is what a lot of us spend a lot of our time doing in the humanities. If we move to this more, or at least if we open ourselves up to thinking in this more collaborative mode, some really, really exciting and very nurturing and nourishing kind of work can come out of that. And the volume is very much an example of what can happen when that is possible. So this was a great time talking with Eben. I hope you enjoy the conversation to come. And I really hope you have a chance to both get your hands on a copy of the book and also explore the website that we talk about that very much exists in relationship with the printed work. They're both really, really inspiring and stimulating and also great fun. So thanks very much for listening. And I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Eben Kirksey about the new book that he just edited called The Multispecies Salon. Welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Eben, and thanks, first of all, for editing an amazing book that I think has really, really wide-ranging, transdisciplinary, multidisciplinary importance, not just to STS, but far beyond that. And also, thanks for making the time and negotiating time differences with me. I'm really, really happy to have you here today.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for inviting me on, Carla.
Great. So, Eben, what are you usually busy researching and writing about when you're not working on the salon?
So one of the projects that I'm working on now is a study of sort of nature and culture in the broadest possible sense in the Americas. So I started working on the multispecies salon as a sideline to a science and technology studies project. I got a National Science Foundation postdoc grant to hang out in Panama and Costa Rica and Florida and do some deep participant observation with scientists. And I had this small little part of the grant that was for a biodiversity conference. And instead of hosting a panel discussion involving experts, I decided to use that money to curate an art show to maybe push the genre of scholarly engagement in a different sort of direction than the usual, 15-minute paper type conference format.
So I love that. And I think this is one of the things that we'll talk quite a lot about as we're talking about the book. I mean, I think there's been a lot of attention lately, even in the past week, I think, on the Chronicle website on the problems, right? And the things we take for granted about regular conference format. I mean, so many of us, I'm sure, have had these frustrating experiences. You go to conferences, there's these stand and deliver talks, everything's choreographed, someone's talking at you. You know, there's this very kind of rigidly designed, at least in principle, if not specifically Q&A, and then we all go home. And I think there's something really, really special about the spirit that you're bringing to the salon book, but also the spirit that you brought to the art exhibit that it sprang from. And so let's talk a little bit about that. So the book came out of a traveling art exhibit, also called the Multi-Species Salon. In this traveling exhibit, as you describe in the introduction, anthropologists, artists, and other scholars together explored three questions. And so I'll take these questions pretty much from the book. The first one, which beings flourish and which fail when natural and cultural worlds intermingle and collide? Second question, what happens when the bodies of organisms and even entire ecosystems are enlisted in the schemes of biotechnology and the dreams of biocapitalism? And third, in the aftermath of disasters, what are the possibilities of biocultural hope? So can you talk a little bit about this salon? Sort of how did you get involved in this salon, and how did you decide to make a book out of this collection of exhibits and pieces?
So instead of issuing a call for paper, a CFP, we issued a different sort of call initially. We invited all sorts of people to bring living things into an art gallery. So we issued a CFO, a call for organisms, and we spread that call to, people who have bona fide credentials in art worlds, but then also people like school kids and anthropologists and other allied intellectuals. And what we were really trying to do is cultivate a space where we might have surprises emerge. So rather than seek out artworks or use artists that had a didactic intent, like a clear message that they wanted to communicate, and just using pretty pictures or installations to communicate a fixed idea, what we were trying to do is craft these objects that get people speaking and thinking differently about issues at hand, and also break down that relationship between object and subject to engage with art as something that might look you in the eye. Living creatures that sometimes, in the show, sometimes were actually created by humans, genetically modified organisms that are dependent on us for care. What's the implications of bringing an organism like that into the gallery and calling it an art object?
Mm-hmm. So the exhibit itself, right, this was a traveling series of events, of gatherings. There were lots of different, it sounds like, kinds of entanglements and kinds of engagements and material experience that were embodied in these exhibits. Can you talk a little bit about the process of moving from this ongoing series of exhibits and very, very different kinds of interactions to producing a book? At what point did you decide that this set of experiences could be translated into a book? And what were some of the most challenging and perhaps some of the most exciting aspects of that translation from series of events to book?
So one piece that might sort of help everyone grapple with how this art exhibit worked as it moved is a piece called Sourdough Cultures that Jake Metcalf brought into the gallery. So basically this was a sourdough starter kit that he got off the internet. It's a culture that crossed the Oregon Trail with the expansion of white settler colonialism, and then in the 90s started propagating itself on the internet. So sourdough cultures are these multi-species assemblages. They pick up new spores, new organisms every time they move. And the art exhibit was very much like that. The salon morphed and mutated as it went into new spaces. We thought about the process of transitioning from a show where we were trying to cultivate these surprises, an open space where parasites and others might emerge. The transition from that very dynamic and open process into a stable book was something like a process of gleaning. So Rustin Hognes, a radio producer in California, has curated an amazing series of interviews about gleanings. So gleanings, in one sense, are the practices that happen after an agricultural harvest. Someone will go into a field and basically be given license to pick up the food that wasn't collected as part of the regular harvest. we thought about gleaning artifacts and detritus, ideas that were left over, things that were discarded in the salon, as a similar process to the editorial project. This in part was a curatorial project. Curate means care, so caring for the artifacts and objects and living organisms that we brought into this space, but then caring for these fragments, these things that were left behind, and cooking up a coherent volume. So all the essays in the book either emerged out of an artwork that was exhibited in the show, or emerged from a presentation that someone gave. So we had Donna Haraway participating in a number of the events, open-ended discussions, Karen Barad, Anna Singh. So it was basically a gathering together, a collection of interesting ideas and artifacts that were left behind.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really love about it is the book actually works really beautifully in concert with a companion website. And I'll make sure that listeners have access to that website link in the write-up on the post that goes with this interview. But this is really, really brilliant because it allows the pieces that are collected in the volume to really take other shape and take other form in the explorations, visual, some cinematic, other sorts of explorations that go with each one of the pieces online. And it also, I think, really pushes us to challenge what we think of as the mode of engaging with a piece of scholarly work. It pushes us off the page and then brings us back onto the page in a way that I think is a really beautiful model for how web and print can interact to produce really innovative experiences for the reader and for the spectator experiencer. Were you from the beginning conceptualizing the website and the book as two integral parts of a single whole? And can you talk a little bit about that relationship between the website and the book and the way that you envision ideally them interacting for the experiencer or reader?
So the website is still very much a living space. So we have a swarm of collaborators who are operating behind the scenes and ever open to new people joining that swarm. Part of what we're doing is assembling a living collection of keywords of multi-species studies. So people are taking words and concepts from the book and then creating these sort of virtual installations, a curated space where video, audio, and prose is coming together to give these ideas a second life of sorts. Originally, I conceptualized it as a more integrative website and book. I wanted to do sort of an ebook where you could have embedded video and this sorts of thing. But during the design process, I really realized that the ebook is where the webpage was in 1995. I think the standards that are being worked out these days are not really well developed. So rather than try to integrate it all into one interface and in a standard that might get outdated in a year or two or five, we decided to have sort of these parallel places. And I think the flexibility that, you know, WordPress, which is the behind the scenes tools we're using to craft the website, you know, it's not a very flashy way of designing a site, but it's sort of built to last. And what we're trying to do is make it a social space where people can interact with it on their own terms.
Mm-hmm. I think it works really, really well. Maybe we'll talk a little bit later about your advice, perhaps for other people who might want to think again with the page, but also think beyond the page as a way to create experience for readers. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit more about what's going on early in the volume. Now, you've already talked about gleaning as one of the conceptual metaphors that really motivates, or at least that comes up early in the book, is something that motivates the way the book and the salon took shape. You also talk about the idea of poaching. Poaching as methodology. You talk about having issued a call for poachers rather than a call for papers. So could you talk a little bit about that, since that seems really central to what's going on throughout the book? What is poaching, and how does that animate for you something important about both the kind of work that the book does and the way that the book works?
So this idea of poaching comes from Michel Desserteaux, who talks about reading as poaching. So in the practice of everyday life, he talks about the sort of game preserve of the elite literati, like philosophers and others, who sort of cordon off these discursive spaces and forbid others to trespass upon them. So this idea of reading as poaching, it really celebrates the way that a reader brings creativity and flair to every text, and rather than sort of set up this oppositional thing where, you know, there's this reified category of person, the author, and then the reader, reading as poaching is an opportunity for intellectuals to engage with each other, to push and to poke and to prod. The Matsutake Worlds Project helped me, understand this practice. It's a collaborative group that Anna Singh and many others formed to study Matsutake, which is this mushroom which has very elaborate chains all around the world of people who collect them. So this collaborative team started using this practice of poaching to do collaboratively authored essays. So one would go do field work in China, and the other would go do field work in the Pacific Northwest, and someone would be working at another place where Matsutake are collected in Europe. And then everyone would bring these texts to the table, and people would push and prod and poke at them. So Liba Fair at UCLA wrote a really brilliant little web intervention for cultural anthropology on the practice of poaching, which we in effect poached for the multi-species salon. And she likens, the practice of poaching is definitely like a chef poaching a pear, you know, sweetening it with honey, adding a little wine. So basically the text is transformed as it's read. So in some of our key events with the multi-species salon, instead of asking people to stand up there and give their standard conference presentations, we put texts on the table that were already published or things that were forthcoming, and invited people to intrude on other people's field sites. We had productive cross readings of people working in very different parts of the world who were able to read into each other's work in creative and productive and transgressive ways.
So this is really exciting for me just to think about, and I'm sure for listeners as well, as a potential model of how we might motivate and organize gatherings where we're, you know, coming together and really making the most out of the fact that we're physically together in a conversational space in the future. So talk me through this a little bit. We're at one day, any day, of this multi-species salon. You've sent out directions to the people who are participating and set up this this kind of poaching situation. So talk us through this. Do you actually suggest, you and the organizers suggest the texts for common poaching, or do you invite the participants to suggest those texts? And then once we're together in the same space, what is an example of what some of the most productive moments for you of this poaching look like?
So it does actually require a lot of behind the scenes work to make these events work. And I think a lot of it's like matchmaking, you know, identifying people who might be from different fields, who might be in totally different conceptual spaces, but who might have generative conversation if they're brought together. So it involved sort of months of planning for some of these events where in part, it's just convincing people that they can productively come to the table and, you know, aligning these different interests. So on the day, I think some of the most dynamic and inspiring interactions were ones where people really did get deep inside each other's projects and, you know, do a little bit more than what a discussant is doing at a conference, to almost, yeah, present someone else's paper as if it was your own, with creative flares and twists. And yeah, I think, you know, to set up an event, to make it work, it helps to both have people who are identified as responsible for getting the conversation going, and then others who maybe have a less scripted role or a clearly identified role in the event, who might function as provocateurs, who might stir the pot a little bit and get those dynamic interchanges. So in part, it is just you know, that classic work of a discussant or of a chair, the intellectual work to identify common threads amongst scholars who might not necessarily already be thinking about their work in the same context. And but yeah, I think that the reframing of that work as poaching, as the work of provocateur, I guess loosens things up a little bit and allows for surprises and dynamic interactions.
Now, it's really clear that in many different ways, and it's probably already clear, I hope, to listeners, even just in the first few minutes of our conversation, collaboration, again, in many ways and on many levels, seems really, really important for multi-species ethnography, for the work of the salon, and also for the work of the volume. Now, in the introduction to the volume, you talk a little bit about the approach that you and your co-authors have taken toward collaborative authorship, right, of some of the pieces collected in the volume, for example. And this is still relatively rare in humanistic scholarship. So to open up a little bit a discussion about collaborative authorship, can you talk to us just a little bit about some of the aspects of that work that you've found particularly important, some of the things that you've done with co-authors that you think have really made things work well that you might want to suggest as models for future kind of kinds of collaboration among humanists?
So, my first book is a study of collaboration. It's a book about an indigenous political movement in West Papua. So I went to West Papua thinking that I was going to find resistance to the forces of globalization and this occupying army. So there I found collaboration was about getting past eternal standoffs between people who are imagined as the enemy, as the other, and finding creative political solutions. Collaboration, you know, obviously has this genealogy. You know, the collaborators in Nazi-occupied France were the ones who sold out the cause, and I think trying to reclaim that word is a really important thing to do, not only in political projects where you can create new coalitions and new temporary alliances to work together on a common object of concern. And I think we really might take inspiration from some of this work being done on political dynamics, indigenous political movements, as we're understanding these multi-species collaborative projects. So there's a lot of people who are talking about bioart, you know, art that uses living matter as its medium, as a collaborative practice. And I think there's a way in certain circles that word is being naively celebrated, not recognizing the conditions of asymmetry, of vulnerability and risk that these other forms of life are subjected to in an art context. On the other hand, I think that collaborative research, collaborative work with colleagues, you know, even though issues of asymmetry and power dynamics and raw exploitation are often at work in these relationships in political realms or in multi-species realms, these relationships can also be incredibly generative. And, you know, complementary expertise really lets you say new things about, you know, about elusive phenomena that are otherwise difficult to study. So in writing a number of these these essays in the book with other people, I found that the collaborative writing with each set of individual authors had a different dynamic. Some would just send snippets of text, and then it was sort of up to me as a poacher or a chef to sort of cook these little snippets of text into a common, seamless narrative. In other collaborative writing projects, we were really, you know, poaching each other, and there wasn't a just sort of one clear editor, but all of us were sort of involved in bringing different snippets of prose together, illuminating, you know, the key argument. It's a more fun process for me than, you know, sitting behind your desk, this solitary practice that so many of us in the humanities and social sciences are trained to do, you know, solitary in a room with a computer alone. So I think it's a great way to reinvigorate scholarship. And I found it was like a side project I could do. So as I was working on my main research in STS, Science and Technology Studies, Ethnography of Science in Latin America and Florida, I felt like I could devote, you know, like snippets of my day to these collaborative exercises, which helped me get out of ruts that I was stuck in, just focused on my own work.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And I think in many ways, and this is just one of them, the work that the book embodies is a model in its form and in its process as well as in its content. So let's talk about, let's move from talking about the collaborative aspect of the form and talk about the structure of the book. So the contributions to the book are organized into three parts, and the first part is called Blasted Landscapes. Now, this part of the book collects three different chapters. One is Hope in Blasted Landscapes, and we'll talk about that in a moment. There's RAW, Raw Ass Milk Soap, which is awesome. They're all awesome. And then there's a piece on Blasted Landscapes and the Gentle Arts of Mushroom Picking. That is a contribution by the Matsutake Worlds Research Group that you've mentioned already in our conversation. So in the first chapter, Hope in Blasted Landscapes, you describe an event in November 2010 where you and others remodeled a warehouse in New Orleans, the Ironworks, into a gallery. And you talk about the importance of this and the context of this. So could you, I'm going to kind of hit the ball back to you. Could you talk to us a little bit about that? What was so important about this remodeling of the warehouse? And what for you was crucial about that process that gets at some of the issues that are most important for you about what's happening in this part of the book?
So that project we were doing in New Orleans took place against the backdrop of a series of disasters. So Hurricane Katrina had recently swept through. As we were working in the setup to the show, the Deepwater Horizon explosion happened, dumping just an unprecedented amount of toxins of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. So the particular space we were working in, this warehouse, had also been blasted in a sense. It was part of this neighborhood that had been hit by capitalism and then abandoned. All sorts of fickle processes were at play. There was a lot of wreckage in the yard, everything from junked cars to hypodermic needles. We inherited a project that was partially restored. So the guy who owned the space, a man named Gilbert, was a New Orleans attorney who had bought this warehouse and was in the process of turning it into an art space and a space for things like weddings and big receptions. And we were the first show, the first art happening that Gilbert was able to showcase in the space. So we were actually on the front lines helping him do some of the hard manual labor. One of the critical insights that emerged from the space is sort of a question of hope for whom. I think in a lot of disaster zones after catastrophe, it's often an opportunity for longstanding powerful interest groups to implement their visions of possible futures. And very much this was happening in New Orleans while we were working. There was talk of redeveloping this neighborhood. A new tram line was going to be put through that part of town, which in effect would bring this process of gentrification into effect. At one point during the setup for the show, the wife of a real estate magnate told us directly, sort of spinning our own words and putting it back to us, that you are all hope and blasted landscape. So, part of what we're trying to do is work against those sorts of trends and creatively play within these spaces contingently opened up by the intersection of capitalism, the privilege that comes with an academic position, the privilege that comes with being an artist in art worlds. One project in particular really worked against that sense of hope for the elite, hope for the bourgeoisie of New Orleans to revivify and recapitalize a space that had been abandoned. This was a project called The Pretty Dough Dairy by Nina Nichols and Amy Jenkins. And what they did was create a relational art project that wasn't bound to the gallery. They had some goats in their backyard. And first of all, they learned a really surprising fact about goat milk. A lot of poison ivy is in New Orleans and in blighted places, properties that have been designated by the city as basically being overgrown. So you start getting a lot of fines if the city designates your plot of land as blighted. And those fines were dispossessing people. People were losing their houses in this cycle of debt and foreclosure as these plants like poison ivy were moving in. So the surprising fact that they learned about goats and poison ivy was that if the goats eat this noxious weed, they'll make milk that serves as a prophylactic to the chemical toxins in the leaves. So they would use the goats to clear poison ivy from the backyards of their neighbors while making lattes that would protect people from poison ivy. So in effect, this art project was ecological and both sort of a human goat plant multi-species assemblage kind of way, but also embodied all sorts of ecological values in human social realms that were about not just gentrifying a neighborhood so that the elite could move back in, but about caring for the people and the landscapes and the organisms that are there to create sort of a biosocial community, a multi-species assemblage that embodied principles of economic justice and anti-racism. So Nina and Amy would take their goats around the St. Roche neighborhood of New Orleans where they lived, where the show took place, learning about the histories of particular plots of land, entering into dialogue with their neighbors, and learning how to help them work together with artists in the community to actualize concrete visions of hope.
Now, one of the really striking things about this part of the book, and actually the next part of the book as well, is how much milk actually flows through. Like you just mentioned, the Pretty Dough Dairy. There's this really concrete way for the reader that the flowing oil, right, the spreading oil that begins this part of the book and this part of the chapter, is kind of countermanded or at least met in its flows with this flowing milk that kind of flows through many of the chapters that's consistently reminding us of, or at least bringing out the importance of, the way that this particular liquid and this particular flow is really intimately connected with place, with particularities, and with care. And that's something that we also see in the Ass Milk Soap chapter, right?
Yeah, so when that proposal for raw ass milk soap in this multi-species salon emerged in my inbox, I initially deleted it. I thought that it was some kind of spam or porn, or I was just like freaked out. I didn't want to engage. But thankfully, one of my other curators, Amy Jenkins, opened that email up and found inside a really smart, compelling experiment in multi-species storytelling that plays with the idea that words often harm the ones we love, especially when the ones we love are non-human animals. So Karen Bolander, the author and artist who works with raw ass milk soap, talks about logos as something that gets in the way. Language is an impediment to telling stories in multi-species worlds for Karen. So she talks about the antibodies that are in milk as these material semiotic elements that tell multi-species stories. So she went on this long journey with an American spotted ass named Alias, and all along the way, Alias was eating things, eating grass, tasting microbes. They're walking through the blasted landscapes of the American South, stopping at places like Oak Ridge, where they built the atomic bomb, walking along highways where strip malls have blasted those landscapes. And at the end, Alias gave birth to another ass called Passenger. Karen didn't realize that Alias was pregnant when she started the journey. And what you learn if you're into animal husbandry, sort of like a basic thing about a pregnant mammal, is that you don't want to expose it to a whole range of places. You want a mother that's about to give birth to be in one place to develop antibodies to the things around it so that those antibodies can be secreted into the milk for the newborn. But what Karen had created was a multi-species story of this journey about entanglements with all these different places, a very nomadic story of wandering through the South. And she talks about the first milk, the colostrum, as this sort of supercharged witch's brew. Her project sometimes explodes when you want to make soap out of milk, whether it's ass milk or cow milk or even human milk. You add lye to it, and if you don't get the timing and the proportions of the lye right, it explodes and it results in this huge mess. So I think that sort of unstable property of the thing itself speaks to the power of the project, and I think it's a really compelling way to think about alternate modes of storytelling that are working to get beyond the limits of language.
Right. And you've just mentioned the phrase or talked a little bit about the importance of entangled places, right? The sort of places and entanglement. And this is also something that is really much, very much at the heart of the next chapter, since you've already mentioned it, right? You've talked a little bit about this Matsutake Worlds research group, and this seems to be so important as a kind of touchstone for many of the pieces and much of the work that's happening in the volume. Did you want to speak a little bit to this project? So for you, as it's instantiated in the book, is there anything that's particularly important about this contribution on behalf of the Matsutake Worlds research group that you'd want to showcase for listeners?
So the Matsutake Worlds project has come up with this really interesting idea about collaboration. So they talk about mycorrhizae, these networks that fungi form underground, connecting different kinds of plants, as a different sort of figure for thinking about collaboration. So mycorrhizae interpenetrate plant roots. A single fungal network can be plugged in to a lot of different plant species, and these networks are channeling resources and information amongst these different living critters. So they're trying to follow the commodity chain of Matsutake mushrooms around the world, trying to think mycorrhizally. So I just think that's a super potent figure for thinking about a lot of these issues. And this phrase blasted landscapes is one that sort of Anna Seng and I are both poaching together in this project. It comes from Bettina Stotzer, someone who works in the urban areas of Germany. She was initially formulating this idea to think about the ecological communities that emerged in the aftermath of the Second World War and these interstitial spaces between East and West Germany. So I think, together with this mycorrhizal project, I think the Matsutake Worlds group offers a really poignant set of figures and metaphors for grappling with multi-species worlds that don't necessarily concern fungi, but that also sort of destabilize dominant ways of talking about, like, animal studies, or now we have critical plant studies. I think the fungal worlds are a really interesting liminal figure that disrupts emerging institutionalized ways of thinking about multi-species worlds.
Yeah, and for listeners who are particularly interested in this, there's this sentence that in this chapter three, that recurs, that's really a touchstone, I think, for a lot of the work in this part of the book. Ruins are now our gardens. And the piece also touches on locality in a very different way than what many of us may be used to in our experience with attentiveness to place and locality. I mean, this piece really takes us into Yunnan and Oregon and Finland and Japan. So for listeners who are especially interested in these kinds of dynamics, chapter three. But this is a book that's actually filled with lots more contributions that take us into the other two parts of the book. So let's get there, even if it's just for a little while. Part two takes us into what's called edible companions. And here we see much more attention given to some of the themes that came up in different ways in the first part of the book, milk, for example, and the importance of eating things. So this is a part of the book that includes an interlude, four recipes, and a chapter, and it takes us into microbiopolitics. It takes us into human milk cheese. There are wonderful needs, reseeds, wool sculptures here. There's acorn mush. There are dandelions that are fed blood. There's all kinds of wonderful stuff happening in this part of the book. So for you, as editor of the volume, are there any particular pieces here that you feel are especially moving or powerful in doing the kind of work that for you is particularly important in this part of the book?
So the edible companion section is about thinking of with critters that are good to live with and also eat. And one of the pieces, the human cheese project, is about maybe denaturing multi-species relations that we take for granted. So a lot of us are drinking milk every day, eating cheese, but don't necessarily think about the conditions of exploitation that the other mammalian bodies are in so that we might enjoy their milk. What sort of diseases do cows have? What sort of antibiotics do they have? What sort of living conditions do they have? When we're talking about human mothers giving milk to a cheese project, everyone wants to talk about those issues, right? So, I hosted a number of tasting events where people brought very different reactions. A lot of the artworks in this collection play with the grotesque. Definitely raw ass milk soap plays, at least in the title, with this idea of the grotesque. And a lot of people, some who are never breastfed, there's also sort of a fetish community, it turns out, of men who buy milk online. So this project of human cheese really tried to expose how biopolitics is functioning, how circuits of matter and meaning are working in the industrialized world, and offer an unconventional way, a strange proposal for rearticulating them that really gets people speaking and thinking differently. And throughout this section, the edible companion section, we're playing with the genre of recipe to think, not just about describing things as they are, but inviting people to sort of take these sections of the book and try to do them themselves. So there's very clear instructions on how to make acorn mush. If you follow them and sort of follow the squirrels in your local communities, at least in North America, you can figure out which are the good acorns to harvest. You want to get there like in the early days of autumn so that you can get the good ones ahead of the squirrels. And it's a time consuming process, but a process that invites all sorts of reflections, reflections on genocide, reflections on surviving white settler colonialism, but also about, looking towards the future and imagining ways of creating biosocial communities that invite others into the community and keep them in the world. The Thneeds Reseeds project is one of my favorites. It's the recipe that I contributed to the book, and it is in very close dialogue with the artwork of Deanna Pendel, an artist that works on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington. And what she did was try to respond to this ongoing disaster in our backyard. Basically, the redwood and Douglas fir communities in that region of the world are routinely clear cut. And in the aftermath of those disasters, the standardized way for responding to them doesn't necessarily work. The replanting regimes are often about maximizing the production potential of these spaces for capital. So what Deanna did was take a book by Dr. Seuss off the shelf, The Lorax, and creatively play with some of the figures in that book. So the Lorax basically had an oppositional politics to capitalism. I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. And ultimately, his speaking for nature pretty much failed. The story by Dr. Seuss is a tragic tale of clear cutting. The truffula trees were turned into these brightly colored sweaters called thneeds that everyone needs. And the narrator of the story, the old onceler, is sort of the specter of dead capital. But the story ends on a hopeful note. The old onceler gives a young boy this little seed, and Deanna is playing with that idea, the figure of a seed. And what she did was invited people to donate sweaters. She put this ad up on Freecycle and said that I need your old funky sweaters for this art project that I'm doing. So she ended up with all these funky Technicolor things from the 70s. And she felted those sweaters using this time-tested process whereby wool fibers adhere to themselves and get, you know, these small felted balls. And she created habitat for one species in particular, silvery bryum, Bryum argentinium, a moss that she describes as a first responder. You can find this moss on roof tiles of Quito, Ecuador, or on the tarmacs of airports like John F. Kennedy here in New York City. So she created a space where that moss might flourish, but also with the sense of creating an opening to possible futures, to create multi-species communities that might flourish beyond the confines of her own imagination. So it turns out that silvery bryum moss encourages the survivalship and germination rates of tree seedlings. She also thought that these little balls she created might serve as habitat for voles and rats and other small animals. But it's really about creating this opening to a possible future, but also doing it in this playful, ironic, but sort of tragic kind of way. She sent 21 thneeds to our art gallery, which she said was enough for one square meter of forest. So she's not saying that we should all go put these small Technicolor wool balls in the forest and hope for the best, but I think she's really trying to encourage us to think outside of the box and to make a commitment to care for a particular place and care in this open-ended, playful way that's not about restoring an imagined past that might not have ever existed in the first place, but creating this generative space where a multi-species flourishing might emerge.
Now, the spirit of play and playful intervention specifically are very much at the heart of the first chapter in the third part of the book. So the third part of the book is entitled Life and Biotechnology, and it includes some really powerful and really moving chapters that get at the heart of these intersecting issues of life and biotech. So in chapter 5, which is a chapter that you co-wrote, we have these figures of kind of playful intervention, like I mentioned, these sorts of trickster figures coming up in the context of this work. So you introduce us to the Reverend of Nanobio Info Cogno. You introduce us to Adam Zaretsky, who's a kind of trickster figure in this context as well. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening in this part of the book in terms of what you feel are some of the most important issues that come out in light of this work?
For me, one of the most important theorists of play is Gregory Bateson, who talked about the meta message that signals this is play, sort of a framing statement that's often not clearly articulated like in humans with words, but, you know, maybe it's a raise of the eyebrow or a slight smile. So Bateson talks about play amongst wolves and the difference between a nip and a bite. So what's the difference between a playful nip and a bite? And it's all about framing for Bateson. And I think in these multi-species species encounters, in particular the one we describe in this chapter with Kathy High and the rats that she purchased, it's often difficult to know how to communicate that meta message, this is play. So Kathy suffers from Crohn's disease, a condition that results in all sorts of intestinal discomfort. And she learned that some rats had been bioengineered to embody her own illness. HLA-B27 was the technical name for these rats. And she just used her university address and placed an order from this farm that grows these transgenic animals. And when the animals first arrived, Kathy was terrified of them and the rats were terrified of her. Kathy's prior experiences with rats had been in New York City, where you could see them running on the subway tracks or scuttling across your foot in an exceptional moment. And it really was a grotesque, almost hideous animal for her, sort of an abject subject. But gradually, both the rats and Kathy learned how to maybe communicate that meta message, like, let's play. Like, here's how we might play. One of the rats in particular learned how to play this game with Kathy, which involved pulling this toilet paper roll back and forth, and she could do it for hours on end. And I think, yeah, figuring out how to play is something that scholars need to work on in a general sense. Gregory Bateson talked about the interplay of rigor and imagination as being the most important thing to scholarship. And I think there's a lot to learn from Bateson. I think in many, many ways, this book is an experiment in trying to bring those two things together and learning how to play.
Now, speaking of learning how to play and the kind of interplay of rigor and imagination, one of the chapters that really showcases this is a chapter that's all about the work of an artist who really begins the book and then ends the book. And this is an artist called Patricia Piccinini. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, but, so she's somebody who produces this amazing, amazing sculptural work that I'm just going to kind of hit this back to you and ask you to talk a little bit about what's going on with Patricia Piccinini's work that you find particularly compelling, and how does it speak to and help open up some of the issues that you feel are really important to this part of the book?
So Patricia Piccinini is an Australian artist based out of Melbourne, and she's technically very skilled. She creates these organisms that are lifelike and realistic that she describes as space aliens that have come to Earth to save particular endangered species. So two of her fabulated organisms that appear in the book are the bodyguard and the surrogate. So if you open up the book and look at page one, the frontispiece, you'll see this creature with big jaws staring back at you. That was the poster child for the first multi-species salon, and it's an image that is challenging. It is frightening, and I often give a lecture to undergraduates and ask them to try to identify this species, and many of them try. They think it looks like a kind of primate. When I tell them it lives in Australia, they're really befuddled and confused. But what this is a creature that Piccinini has playfully created to get us thinking differently about endangered species. So the bodyguard is for a little bird called the helmeted honey eater, or hiho. And this bird lives near Melbourne and basically is severely endangered because of, you know, habitat loss, the typical story of, you know, development and pesticides and introduced species that have become predators, things like cats. So Piccinini's introducing this idea that maybe there is this potential of salvation, but she's playing with these tropes. really unsettling conventional ways of thinking about these issues. So Donna Haraway's contributed an amazing essay about Piccinini's work to the Multispecies Salon, where she's exploring speculative fabulations and science fictions, and using Piccinini's work to diagnose sort of a lot of problems we have in the humanities and social sciences when we approach issues like conservation, really pointing to some of the uncomfortable aspects of what happens to a species when it becomes endangered, you know, the sorts of violences that are, put into play on individual animals in the name of saving a species, but also sort of opening it up to think about ways of flourishing in situations that have these long legacies of colonialism, capitalism. She talks about doing the wrong thing for the right reasons, and maybe letting aliens loose on Earth to save endangered animals is an example of that, doing the wrong thing for the right reasons.
Thank you so much. Now, we have talked about a couple of the pieces in the third part of the book, Life in Biotech. And before we leave this part of the book and kind of move out to wrapping things up, are there any other pieces that come up here in these three chapters, the Brittle Star chapter, the Piccinini chapter, the Age of Biotech chapter, that you feel are particularly compelling or moving that you'd like to bring to the attention of listeners?
Yeah, I think Karen Barad's piece on the Brittle Star is a really excellent distillation of some of her ideas about intra-action. So the Brittle Star doesn't have eyes. It is an eye. So the whole exoskeleton of this animal can sense light and dark. And she talks about the ways that this animal is intraactively engaging with the world. So interaction for Barad is different from interaction. So if you picture two billiard balls bouncing off of each other, they might change the direction that they're traveling in, but they don't really, you know, their essence or their mode of being in the world isn't torqued. The Brittle Star, she shows, intra-acts with the world in these relations of becoming. So I think that essay in particular is a really accessible distillation of Barad's very intricate and quite complex corpus of ideas.
Thank you so much, Evan. Now, before we kind of come to our conclusion and wrap things up, just to move outward from the book for a moment and to reflect back on the series of gatherings from which the book emerged, for other listeners who may be listening to this and may go to the website and the book and explore and may want to enact or curate kinds of gatherings that similarly move us away from the traditional stand and deliver conference to a more poaching oriented, a more collaborative model of interaction among colleagues coming from very different fields and kinds of work. Do you have any kind of major points of advice? Definitely do this, definitely don't do this, for other scholars and artists and thinkers who might want to be curating similar, if not in type, similar in spirit, kinds of gatherings for producing sorts of entanglements and conversations.
So a lot of folks are already starting to play with sort of the format of the salon. Katie King just staged one for her students at the University of Maryland, and Celia Lowe, actually this week, tomorrow, is doing one with her students at the University of Washington in Seattle. And I think, yeah, like staging these creative spaces of play is a great thing to do with undergrads and I think graduate students alike and also colleagues. I think some of the things to think about are that very serious boundaries do have to be maintained in certain circumstances. So, for example, one of the pieces highlighted in the book, Life Cycle of a Common Weed, which involves feeding blood to dandelions, that was shut down by a number of galleries because the paranoid biosafety people weren't convinced that the artist was capable of technically keeping everyone safe. In this particular case, Caitlin Bergeron, the artist, was very technically capable, and it was sort of misplaced paranoia. So Caitlin had gotten a certificate in phlebotomy. She'd learned how to take the blood of other people and herself and do so in a very sterile, safe way. So what motivates Caitlin's project is this recognition that her own blood, she got contaminated with hepatitis C as a young girl. She got a blood transfusion with infected blood. So her own blood, which would be harmful to other humans, is nutritious to plants because it has nitrogen. I would only do that intervention if you have a certificate in phlebotomy. Don't do that at home unless you are willing to seriously commit to that sort of technical expertise. And then I think the other thing is, like, caring for living matter, living organisms, whether they be plants or fruit flies or rats, takes a very serious commitment. We've done some art interventions with Xenopus frogs that live to be 30 years old. So if you're planning to work with animals to do playful interventions with fruit flies or whatever, you have to seriously think about the issues at stake. You know, it is possible to do experimental interventions with art, even in your own home, that attend to the needs of the animal, to what it needs to flourish. But it's not something to take on lightly. So, in doing these things well, it takes a lot of technical know-how, serious preparation. But if you do that and sort of choose which playful interventions to stage carefully, I think these sorts of playful interventions can be very productive and generative.
And one of the things I really like too about the spirit and the practice of these gatherings that you're modeling for us here and that you've kind of concretized here in the volume is it really reminds us that care for other beings, I think, extends to care for each other as people, which isn't often something that we keep in mind right at the front of our minds when we're organizing academic events and engaging with each other as academics. I think there's something really to be said for moving to a kind of sphere where we can think of our interactions with each other as well as interactions of care. And that might also help open up certain kinds of possibilities for us as artists and scholars and thinkers and as a community.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think I'd go back to that word curate again, which at its Latin root means to care. So thinking about scholarly practice as a curatorial practice, I think can be very generative.
So, Evan, there's a lot in the book that we didn't have a chance to get to, even though we touched on, I think, a lot of what are among the most exciting of many, many exciting parts of the book. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Let's see. I think just make some of the recipes. I think that's my main advice in becoming a real poacher with this book is to actually try to make some of the recipes. They're not that hard. You can get human milk on the internet. There's an online marketplace for human milk, onlythebreast.com. Acorns are very easily obtainable. Pinyon nuts you can find if you live in the American Southwest. So I think just as a provocation to readers, don't just read, make.
Cool. So now that the book is out, and congratulations on what I hope is obvious is a really exciting volume, what's next for you? What are you currently working on that's inspiring you?
So the project that I was working on in parallel to this is also coming to fruition. It's a new book called Emergent Ecologies, and it's coming out in November with Duke University Press. Ken Wissaker, my editor at Duke, has worked with me on three projects now, and I love him to death, and I love the press. So maybe I'll just say a little bit. Do I have time to say
little
bit about Emergent Ecologies?
Of course.
So it's a book that follows the flight of capital and multiple species across the fragmented landscapes of the Americas. So mostly it's in Panama, Costa Rica, Florida, places that very much are structured by these legacies of imperialism, where things are emerging that are somewhat different from the past. One of the chapters talks about the bombs that were left behind by the U.S. military in Panama as strange figures of hope, as these sort of cyborg rivets that fasten ecosystems into place. Often these bombs are functioning as talismans, protecting individual creatures and whole multi-species communities from incursions by people, from capitalist development, but sometimes they explode and result in violent pain and death, killing people and also tapirs and other forms of wildlife that have come to depend on them for their existence. So in addition to these blasted landscapes that are riddled with bombs and chemical weapons, the book also describes attempts to sort of save the day. The amphibian ark is this transnational infrastructure that has been built to protect frogs from an emergent disease, a fungus called chytrid. So I'm sort of chronicling the dreams and hopes that are pinned on this architecture, and also delving into the worlds of chytrids. And I use a lot of experimental tactics in the book. Rather than just showing up with a microphone and interviewing people, I built on some of the art collaborations that I did with the multi-species salon to, hack into a refrigerator to create a temporary utopia for frogs that are being killed by conservationists. And I also partnered with some ethnoprimatologists, some people who are experts at studying primates, monkeys in particular, rhesus macaques, to chronicle emergent forms of life in Florida, the place where I was born. So I've been hearing rumors since my youth of these monkeys that were on the loose in Florida, rumored to escape from the Tarzan films. And I went to study these monkeys, both using ethnographic methods, but also ethological methods. So in part, this book is a methodological experiment, asking, what the tools of ethnography, ethology, and bioart might have to say about the current historical moment and the emergence of ecological communities. But it's also sort of a theoretical exploration of some of the cosmopolitical ideas of Isabel Stengers, who talks about the sort of articulations that one might make with others in the world against the background of an unknown cosmos, rethinking this debate about novel ecosystems with the help of Foucault, Nietzsche, and others to think about surprising emergences that are either disrupting the established order or forming new worlds in our midst.
Wow. So I will eagerly anticipate that as well. Best of luck finishing all of that up. And thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure, and congratulations on an awesome book.
Thanks, Carla.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.